Our squad car friends would breathlessly repeat the message a few times, and without fucking it up, that Sergeant Doakes himself would be at the party tonight, live and in person, around 9 o'clock. And for my part, with my work done for a few hours, I headed for Jackson Memorial Hospital to look in on my favorite bird with a broken wing. Deborah was wrapped in an upper body cast, sitting in bed in a sixth-floor room with a lovely view of the freeway. And although I was sure they were giving her some kind of painkiller, she didn't look at all blissful when I walked into the room. "God damn it, Dexter," she greeted me. "Tell them to let me the hell out of here, or at least give me my clothes so I can leave."
"I'm glad to see you're feeling better, sister dear," I said.
"You'll be on your feet in no time." "I'll be on my feet the second they give me my goddamn clothes," she said. "What the hell is going on out there? What have you been doing?"
"Doakes and I have set a rather neat trap, and Doakes is the bait," I said. "If Dr. Danko bites, we'll have him tonight at my, party. Vince's party," I added, and I realized I wanted to distance myself from the whole idea of being engaged. And it was a silly way to do it, but I felt better anyway. Which apparently brought no comfort to Debs.
"Your engagement party?" she said, and then snarled. "Shit. You got Doakes to set himself up for you."
And I admit it sounded kind of elegant when she said it, but I didn't want her thinking such things. Unhappy people heal slower.
"No, Deborah, seriously," I said in my best soothing voice. "We're doing this to catch Dr. Danko."
She glared at me for a long time, and then, amazingly, she sniffled and fought back a tear.
"I have to trust you," she said. "But I hate this. All I can think about is what he's doing to Kyle."
"This will work, Debs. We'll get Kyle back." And because she was, after all, my sister, I didn't add, or most of him, anyway.
"Christ, I hate being stuck here," she said. "You need me there for backup."
"We can handle this, sis," I said. "There will be a dozen cops at the party, all armed and dangerous. And I'll be there, too," I said, feeling just a little miffed that she so undervalued my presence. But she continued to do so.
"Yeah, and if Doakes gets Danko, we get Kyle back. If Danko gets Doakes, you're off the hook. Real slick, Dexter. You win either way."
"That had never occurred to me," I lied. "My only thought is to serve the greater good. Besides, Doakes is supposed to be very experienced at this sort of thing. And he knows Danko."
"God damn it, Dex, this is killing me. What if..."
She broke off and bit her lip.
"This better work," she said. "He's had Kyle too long."
"This will work, Deborah," I said. But neither one of us really believed me. The doctors quite firmly insisted on keeping Deborah for 24 hours, for observation. And so, with a hearty hi-ho to my sister, I galloped off into the sunset, and from there to my apartment for a shower and change of clothes. What to wear? I could think of no guidelines on what we were wearing this season to a party forced on you to celebrate an unwanted engagement that might turn into a violent confrontation with a vengeful maniac. Clearly, brown shoes were out, but beyond that, nothing really seemed de rigueur. After careful consideration, I let simple good taste guide me, and selected a lime green Hawaiian shirt covered with red electric guitars and pink hot rods. Simple, but elegant. A pair of khaki pants and some running shoes, and I was ready for the ball. But there was still an hour left before I had to be there, and I found my thoughts turning again to Cody. Was I right about him? If so, how could he deal with his awakening passenger on his own? He needed my guidance, and I found that I was eager to give it to him. I left my apartment and drove south, instead of north, to Vince's house. In 15 minutes, I was knocking at Rita's door and staring across the street at the empty spot formerly occupied by Sergeant Doakes in his maroon Taurus. Tonight he was no doubt at home, preparing, girding his loins for the coming conflict and polishing his bullets. Would he try to kill Dr. Danko, secure in the knowledge that he had legal permission to do so? How long had it been since he killed something? Did he miss it? Did the need come roaring over him like a hurricane, blowing away all the reason and restraints? The door opened. Rita beamed and lunged at me, wrapping me in a hug and kissing me on the face. "Hey, handsome," she said. "Come on in." I hugged back briefly, for form's sake, and then disengaged myself. "I can't stay very long," I said. She beamed bigger. "I know," she said. "Vince called and told me. He was so cute about the whole thing. He promised me he would keep an eye on you so you wouldn't do anything too crazy." "Come inside," she said, and dragged me in by the arm. When she closed the door, she turned to me, suddenly serious. "Listen, Dexter, I want you to know that I'm not the jealous type, and I trust you. You just go and have fun." "I will, thank you," I said, although I doubted that I would. And I wondered what Vince had said to make her think that the party would be some kind of dangerous pit of temptation and sin. For that matter, it might well be. Since Vince was largely synthetic, he could be somewhat unpredictable in social situations, as shown by his bizarre duels of sexual innuendo with my sister. "It was sweet of you to stop here before the party," Rita said, leading me to the couch where I'd spent so much of my recent life. "The kids wanted to know why they couldn't go." "I'll talk to them," I said, eager to see Cody and try to discover if I had been right. Rita smiled, as if thrilled to learn that I would actually talk to Cody and Aster. "They're out back," she said. "I'll go get them." "No, stay here," I said. "I'll go out." Cody and Aster were in the yard with Nick, the surly clout from next door who had wanted to see Aster naked. They looked up as I slid the door open, and Nick turned away and scurried back to his own yard. Aster ran over to me and gave me a hug, and Cody trailed behind, watching, no emotion at all on his face. "Hi," he said in his quiet voice. "Greetings and salutations, young citizens," I said. "Shall we put on our formal togas? Caesar calls us to the Senate." Aster cocked her head to one side and looked at me as if she had just seen me eat a raw cat. Cody merely said, "What?" very quietly. "Dexter," Aster said, "why can't we go to the party with you?" "In the first place," I told her, "it's a school night. And in the second place, I am very much afraid this is a grown-up party." "Does that mean that there will be naked girls there?" she asked. "What kind of person do you think I am?" I said, scowling fiercely. "Do you really think I would ever go to a party with no naked girls?" "Ew," she said, and Cody whispered, "Ha." But more important, there will also be stupid dancing and ugly shirts. And these are not good for you to see. You would lose all your respect for grown-ups.
"What respect?" Cody said, and I shook him by the hand.
"Well said," I told him. "Now go to your room." Aster finally giggled.
"But we want to go to the party," she said.
"I'm afraid not," I said. "But I brought you a piece of treasure, so you won't run away." I handed her a roll of Necco wafers, our secret currency. She would split it evenly with Cody later, out of sight of all prying eyes. "Now then, young persons," I said. They looked up at me expectantly. But at that point, I was stuck, all aquiver with eagerness to know the answer, but not at all sure where or even how to start asking. I couldn't very well say, "By the way, Cody, I was wondering if you like to kill things."
That, of course, was exactly what I wanted to know, but it didn't really seem like the kind of thing you could say to a child, especially Cody, who was generally about as talkative as a coconut. His sister Aster, though, often seemed to speak for him. The pressures of spending their early childhood together with a violent ogre for a father had created a symbiotic relationship so close that when he drank soda, she would burp. Whatever might be going on inside Cody, Aster would be able to express it. "Can I ask you something very serious?" I said, and they exchanged a look that contained an entire conversation, but said nothing to anyone else. Then they nodded to me, almost as if their heads were mounted together on a foosball rod. "The neighbor's dog," I said.
"Told you," Cody said.
"He was always knocking over the garbage," Aster said, "and pooping in our yard. And Nikki tried to make him bite us."
"So Cody took care of him?" I asked.
"He's the boy," said Aster. "He likes to do that stuff. I just watch. Are you going to tell Mom?"
There it was. "He likes to do that stuff." I looked at the two of them, watching me with no more worry than if they had just said they liked vanilla ice cream better than strawberry. "I won't tell your mom," I said. "But you can't tell anybody else in the world. Not ever. Just the three of us. Nobody else. Understand?"
"Okay,"
Aster said, with a glance at her brother.
"But why, Dexter?"
"Most people won't understand," I said. "Not even your mom."
"You do,"
said Cody in his husky near whisper. "Yes," I said, "and I can help." I took a deep breath and felt an echo rolling through my bones, down across the years from Harry so long ago to me right now. Under the same Florida nightscape Harry and I had stood under when he said the same thing to me. "We have to get you squared away," I said, and Cody looked at me with large, blinkless eyes and nodded.
"Okay,"
he said. Chapter 23. Vince Masuoka had a small house in North Miami, at the end of a dead-end street off Northeast 125th Street. It was painted pale yellow with pastel purple trim, which really made me question my taste in associates. There were a few very well-barbered bushes in the front yard, and a cactus garden by the front door. And he had a row of those solar-powered lamps lighting the cobblestone walkway to his front door. I had been there once before, a little more than a year ago, when Vince had decided for some reason to have a costume party. I had taken Rita, since the whole purpose of having a disguise is to be seen wearing it. She had gone as Peter Pan, and I was Zorro, of course, the Dark Avenger with a ready blade. Vince had answered the door in a body-hugging satin gown with a basket of fruit on his head. "J. Edgar Hoover?" "Edgar," I asked him. "You're very close. Carmen Miranda," he had said, before leading us in to a fountain of lethal fruit punch. I had taken one sip and decided to stick with the sodas, but of course that had been before my conversion to a beer-swilling, red-blooded male. There had been a non-stop soundtrack of monotonous techno-pop music turned up to a volume designed to induce voluntary self-performed brain surgery, and the party had gotten exceedingly loud and hilarious. As far as I knew, Vince hadn't entertained since then, at least not on that scale. Still, the memory apparently lingered, and Vince had no trouble in gathering an enthusiastic crowd to join in my humiliation with only 24 hours' notice. True to his word, there were dirty movies playing all over the house on a number of video monitors he had set up, even out back on his patio. And, of course, The fruit punch fountain was back. Because the rumors of that first party were still fresh on the grapevine, the place was packed with rowdy people, mostly male, who attacked the punch like they had heard there was a prize for the first one to achieve permanent brain damage. I even knew a few of the partiers. Angel Batista, no relation, was there from work, along with Camilla Figg and a handful of other forensic lab geeks, and a few cops I knew, including the four who had not fucked it up for Sergeant Doakes. The rest of the crowd seemed to be pulled off South Beach at random, chosen for their ability to make a loud, high-pitched whoo sound when the music changed or the video monitor showed something particularly undignified. It didn't take long at all for the party to settle into something we would all regret for a very long time. By 9:15, I was the only one left who could still stand upright, unassisted. Most of the cops had camped out by the fountain in a grim clod of rapidly bending elbows. Angel, no relation, was lying under the table, sound asleep, with a smile on his face. His pants were gone, and someone had shaved a bear streak down the center of his head. Things being as they were, I thought this would be an ideal time to slip outside undetected to see if Sergeant Doakes had arrived yet. As it turned out, however, I was wrong. I had taken no more than 2 steps toward the door when a great weight came down on me from behind. I spun around quickly to find that Camilla Figg was attempting to drape herself across my back. "Hi," she said, with a very bright and somewhat slurred smile. "Hello," I said cheerfully. "Can I get you a drink?" She frowned at me. "Don't need drink. Just want to say hello." She frowned harder. "Jeez Christ, you're cute," she said. "I always wanted to tell you that." Well, the poor thing was obviously drunk, but even so. Cute? Me? I suppose too much alcohol can blur the sight, but come on. What could possibly be cute about someone who would rather cut you open than shake your hand? And in any case, I was already way over my limit for women with one, Rita. As far as I could recall, Camilla and I had rarely said more than 3 words to each other. She had never before mentioned my alleged cuteness. She had seemed to avoid me, in fact, preferring to blush and look away rather than say a simple good morning. And now she was practically raping me. Did that make sense? In any case, I had no time to waste on deciphering human behavior. "Thank you very much," I said as I tried to undrape Camilla without causing any serious injuries to either of us. She had locked her hands around my neck, and I pried at them, but she clung like a barnacle. "I think you need some fresh air, Camilla," I said, hoping that she might take the hint and wander away out back. Instead, she lunged closer, mashing her face against mine as I frantically backpedaled away. "I'll take my fresh air right here," she said. She squeezed her lips into a pouty kissy face and pushed me back until I bumped into a chair and nearly fell over. "Would you like to sit down?" I asked hopefully. "No," she said, pulling me downward toward her face with what felt like at least twice her actual weight. "I would like to screw." Well, I stammered, overcome by the absolute shocking effrontery and absurdity of it. Were all human women crazy? Not that the men were any better. The party around me looked like it had been arranged by Hieronymus Bosch, with Camilla ready to drag me behind the fountain, where no doubt a gang with bird beaks was waiting to help her ravish me. But it hit me that I now had the perfect excuse to avoid ravishment. I am getting married, you know. As difficult as it was to admit, it was only fair that it come in handy once in a while. "Bastard," Camilla said. "Beautiful bastard." She slumped suddenly and her arms flopped off my neck. I barely managed to catch her and keep her from falling to the floor.
Probably so, I said. But in any case, I think you need to sit down for a few minutes. I tried to ease her into the chair, but it was like pouring honey onto a knife blade, and she flowed off onto the floor.
Beautiful bastard,
she said, and closed her eyes. It's always nice to learn that you are well regarded by your co-workers, but my romantic interlude had used up several minutes, and I very much needed to get out front and check in with Sergeant Doakes. And so, leaving Camilla to slumber sweetly amid her dewy dreams of love, I headed for the front door once again. And once again I was waylaid, this time by a savage attack on my upper arm. Vince himself grabbed my bicep and pulled me away from the door and back into surrealism.
"Hey," he yodeled. "Hey, party boy, where you going?"
"I think I left my keys in my car," I said, trying to disengage from his death grip, but he just yanked at me harder.
"No, no, no," he said, pulling me toward the fountain. "It's your party. You're not going anywhere."
"It's a wonderful party, Vince," I said, "but I really need to drink," he said, splashing a cup into the fountain and pushing it at me so it slopped onto my shirt.
"That's what you need. Banzai!"
He held his own cup up in the air and then drained it. Happily, for all concerned, the drink sent him into a coughing fit, and I managed to slip away as he doubled over and struggled for air. I made it all the way out the front door and partway down the walk before he appeared at the door.
"Hey," he yelled at me, "you can't leave yet. The strippers are coming."
"I'll be right back," I called. "Fix me another drink."
"Right,"
he said with his phony smile.
"Ha! Banzai!"
And he went back into the party with a cheery wave. I turned to look for Doakes. He had been parked right across the street from wherever I was for so long that I should have spotted him immediately, but I didn't. When I finally saw the familiar maroon Taurus, I realized what a clever thing he had done. He was parked up the street under a large tree, which blocked any light from the streetlights. It was the kind of thing a man trying to hide might do, but at the same time it would allow Dr. Danko to feel confident that he could get close without being seen. I walked over to the car, and as I approached, the window slid down. "He's not here yet," Doakes said. "You're supposed to come in for a drink," I said. "I don't drink." "You obviously don't go to parties either, or you would know that you can't do them properly sitting across the street in your car." Sergeant Doakes didn't say anything, but the window rolled up and then the door opened and he stepped out. "What are you going to do if he comes now?" he asked me. "Count on my charm to save me," I said. "Now come on in while there's still someone conscious in there." We crossed the street together, not actually holding hands, but it seemed so odd under the circumstances that we might as well have. Halfway across, a car turned the corner and came down the street toward us. I wanted to run and dive into a row of oleanders, but was very proud of my icy control when instead I merely glanced at the oncoming car. It cruised slowly along, and Sergeant Doakes and I were all the way across the street by the time it got to us. Doakes turned to look at the car, and I did too. A row of five sullen teen faces looked out at us. One of them turned his head and said something to the others, and they laughed. The car rolled on by. "We better get inside," I said. "They looked dangerous." Doakes didn't respond. He watched the car turn around at the end of the street and then continued on his way to Vince's front door. I followed along behind, catching up with him just in time to open the front door for him. I had only been outside for a few minutes, but the body count had grown impressively. Two of the cops beside the fountain were stretched out on the floor, and one of the South Beach refugees was throwing up into a Tupperware container that had held Jell-O salad a few minutes ago. The music was pounding louder than ever, and from the kitchen I heard Vince yelling, "Banzai!" joined by a ragged chorus of other voices. "Abandon all hope," I said to Sergeant Doakes, and he mumbled something that sounded like, "Sick motherfuckers." He shook his head and went in.
This ends Disc 6. Dearly Devoted Dexter, Disc 7.
Doakes didn't take a drink, and he didn't dance, either. He found a corner of the room with no unconscious body in it, and just stood there, looking like a cut-rate Grim Reaper at a frat party. I wondered if I should help him get into the spirit of the thing. Perhaps I could send Camilla Fig over to seduce him. I watched the good sergeant stand in his corner and look around him, and I wondered what he was thinking. It was a lovely metaphor, Doakes standing silent and alone in a corner, while all around him human life raged riotously on. I probably would have felt a wellspring of sympathy for him bubbling up, if only I could feel. He seemed completely unaffected by the whole thing, not even reacting when two of the South Beach gang ran past him naked. His eyes fell on the nearest monitor, which was portraying some rather startling and original images involving animals. Doakes looked at it without interest or emotion of any kind. Just a look. Then his gaze moved on to the cops on the floor, Angel under the table, and Vince leading a conga line in from the kitchen. His gaze traveled all the way over to me, and he looked at me with the same exact lack of expression. He crossed the room and stood in front of me. "How long we gotta stay?" he asked. I gave him my very best smile. "It is a bit much, isn't it? All this happiness and fun. It must make you nervous." "Makes me want to wash my hands," he said. "I'll wait outside." "Is that really a good idea?" I asked. He tilted his head at Vince's conga line, which was collapsing in a heap of spastic hilarity. "Is that?" he said. And of course he had a point. Although in terms of sheer lethal pain and terror, a conga line on the floor couldn't really compete with Dr. Danko. Still, I suppose one has to consider human dignity, if it truly exists somewhere. At the moment, looking around the room, that didn't seem possible. The front door swung open. Both Doakes and I turned to face it, all our reflexes up on tiptoe. And it was a good thing we were ready for danger, because otherwise we might have been ambushed by two half-naked women carrying a boombox. "Hello?" they called out, and were rewarded with a ragged, high-pitched roar of "Woo!" from the conga line on the floor. Vince struggled out from under the pile of bodies and swayed to his feet. "Hey!" he shouted. "Hey, everybody! Strippers are here! Banzai!" There was an even louder "Woo!" and one of the cops on the floor struggled to his knees, swaying gently and staring as he mouthed the word "strippers." Doakes looked around the room and back at me. "I'll be outside," he said, and turned for the door. "Doakes," I said, thinking it really wasn't a good idea. But I got no more than one step after him when once again I was savagely ambushed. "Gotcha!" Vince roared out, holding me in a clumsy bear hug. "Vince, let me go," I said. "No way," he chortled. "Hey, everybody, help me out with the blushing bridegroom." There was a surge of ex-conga liners from the floor and the last standing cop by the fountain, and I was suddenly at the center of a mini mosh pit, the press of bodies heaving me toward the chair where Camilla Fig had passed out and rolled onto the floor. I struggled to get away, but it was no use. There were too many of them, too filled with Vince's rocket juice. I could do nothing but watch as Sergeant Doakes, with a last molten stone glare, went through the front door and out into the night. They levered me into the chair and stood around me in a tight half circle, and it was obvious that I was going nowhere. I hoped Doakes was as good as he thought he was, because he was clearly on his own for a while. The music stopped, and I heard a familiar sound that made the hairs on my arms stand up straight. It was the ratchet of duct tape spooling off the roll, my own favorite prelude to a concerto for knife blade. Someone held my arms, and Vince wrapped three big loops of tape around me, fastening me to the chair. It was not tight enough to hold me, but it would certainly slow me enough to allow the crowd to keep me in the chair.
"All righty, then," Vince called out, and one of the strippers turned on her boombox, and the show began.
The first stripper, a sullen-looking black woman, began to undulate in front of me while removing a few unnecessary items of clothing. When she was almost naked, she sat on my lap and licked my ear while wiggling her butt. Then she forced my head between her breasts, arched her back, and leaped backward. And the other stripper, a woman with Asian features and blonde hair, came forward and repeated the whole process. When she had wiggled around on my lap for a few moments, she was joined by the first stripper, and the two of them sat together, one on each side of me. Then they leaned forward so that their breasts rubbed my face and began to kiss each other. At this point, dear Vince brought them each a large glass of his murderous fruit punch, and they drank it off, still wiggling rhythmically. One of them muttered, "Woo, good punch." I couldn't tell which one of them said it, but they both seemed to agree. The two women began to writhe a great deal more now, and the crowd around me began to howl like it was full moon at a rabies convention. Of course, my view was somewhat obscured by four very large and unnaturally hard breasts, two in each shade, but at least it sounded like everyone except me was having a great deal of fun. Sometimes you have to wonder if there is some kind of malign force with a sick sense of humor running our universe. I knew enough about human males to know that most of them would happily trade their excess body parts to be where I was. And yet, all I could think of was that I would be equally pleased to trade a body part or two to get out of this chair and away from the naked, squirming women. Of course, I would have preferred it to be somebody else's body part, but I would cheerfully collect it. But there was no justice. The two strippers sat there on my lap, bouncing to the music and sweating all over my beautiful rayon shirt and each other, while around us the party raged on. After what seemed like an endless spell in purgatory, broken only by Vince bringing the strippers two more drinks, the two roiling women finally moved off my lap and danced around the circling crowd. They touched faces, sipped from the partier's drinks, and grabbed at an occasional crotch. I used the distraction to free my hands and remove the duct tape, and it was only then that I noticed that no one was paying any attention at all to Dimpled Dexter, the theoretical man of the hour. One quick look around showed me why. Everyone in the room was standing in a slack-jawed circle watching the two strippers as they danced, completely naked now, glistening with sweat and spilled drinks. Vince looked like a cartoon the way he stood there with his eyes almost bulged out of his head. But he was in good company. Everyone who was still conscious was in a similar pose, staring without breathing, swaying slightly from side to side. I could have barreled through the room, blasting away on a flaming tuba, and no one would have paid me any attention. I stood up, walked carefully around behind the crowd, and slipped out the front door. I had thought that Sergeant Doakes would wait somewhere near the house, but he was nowhere to be seen. I walked across the street and looked in his car. It was empty, too. I looked up and down the street, and it was the same. There was no sign of him. Doakes was gone.
Chapter 24. There are many aspects of human existence that I will never understand, and I don't just mean intellectually. I mean that I lack the ability to empathize, as well as the capacity to feel emotion. To me, it doesn't seem like much of a loss, but it does put a great many areas of ordinary human experience completely outside my comprehension. However, there is one almost overwhelmingly common human experience I feel powerfully, and that is temptation. And as I looked at the empty street outside Vince Masuoka's house
and realized that somehow Dr. Danko had taken Doakes, I felt it wash over me in dizzying, near-suffocating waves. I was free. The thought surged around me and pummeled me with its elegant and completely justified simplicity. It would be the easiest thing in the world just to walk away. Let Doakes have his reunion with the doctor, report it in the morning, and pretend that I'd had too much to drink. My engagement party, after all. And I wasn't really sure what had happened to the good sergeant. And who would contradict me? Certainly no one inside at the party could say anything approaching realistic certainty that I was not watching the peep show with them the whole time. Doakes would be gone, whisked away forever into a final haze of lopped-off limbs and madness, never to lighten my dark doorway again. Liberty for Dexter, free to be me, and all I had to do was absolutely nothing. Even I could handle that. So why not walk away? For that matter, why not take a slightly longer stroll down to Coconut Grove, where a certain children's photographer had been waiting for my attentions much too long? So simple, so safe. Why, indeed, not? A perfect night for a dark delight with a downbeat. The moon nearly full and that small missing edge lending the whole thing a casual, informal air. The urgent whispers agreed, rising in a hissed, insistent chorus. It was all there. Time and target, and most of a moon, and even an alibi. And the pressure had been growing for so long now that I could close my eyes and let it happen all by itself, walk through the whole happy thing on autopilot. And then the sweet release again, the afterglow of buttery muscles with all the knots drained out, the happy coasting into my first complete sleep of far too long now. And in the morning, rested and relieved, I would tell Deborah, oh, Deborah. There was that, wasn't there? I would tell Deborah that I had taken the sudden opportunity of a no-dokes zone and gone dashing into the darkness with a need and a knife as the last few fingers of her boyfriend trickled away into a trash heap. Somehow, even with my inner cheerleaders insisting that it would be all right, I didn't think she would go for it. It had the feeling of something final in my relationship with my sister, a small lapse in judgment, perhaps, but one she would find a bit hard to forgive, and even though I am not capable of feeling actual love, I did want to keep Debs relatively happy with me. And so, once again, I was left with virtuous patience and a feeling of long-suffering rectitude. Dour, dutiful Dexter. It will come, I told my other self. Sooner or later, it will come. Has to come. It will not wait forever, but this must come first. And there was some grumbling, of course, because it hadn't come in far too long. But I soothed the growls, rattled the bars with false good cheer one time, and pulled out my cell phone. I dialed the number Doakes had given me. After a moment there was a tone, and then nothing, just a faint hiss. I punched in the long access code, heard a click, and then a neutral female voice said, "Number." I gave the voice Doakes's cell number. There was a pause, and then it read me some coordinates. I hurriedly scribbled them down on the pad. The voice paused and then added, "Moving due west, 65 miles per hour." The line went dead. I never claimed to be an expert navigator, but I do have a small GPS unit that I use on my boat. It comes in handy for marking good fishing spots. So I managed to put in the coordinates without bumping my head or causing an explosion. The unit Doakes had given me was a step up from mine and had a map on the screen.
The coordinates on the map translated to Interstate 75, heading for Alligator Alley, the corridor to the west coast of Florida. I was mildly surprised. Most of the territory between Miami and Naples is Everglades, swamp broken up by small patches of semi-dry land. It was filled with snakes, alligators, and Indian casinos, which didn't seem at all like the kind of place to relax and enjoy a peaceful dismemberment. But the GPS couldn't lie, and supposedly neither could the voice on the phone. If the coordinates were wrong, it was Doakes's doing, and he was lost anyway. I had no choice. I felt a little guilty about leaving the party without thanking my host, but I got into my car and headed for I-75. I was up on the interstate in just a few minutes, then quickly north to I-75. As you head west on 75, the city gradually thins away. Then there was one final furious explosion of strip malls and houses just before the toll booth for Alligator Alley. At the booth, I pulled over and called the number again. The same neutral female voice gave me a set of coordinates, and the line went dead. I took it to mean that they were no longer moving. According to the map, Sergeant Doakes and Dr. Danko were now settling comfortably into the middle of an unmarked watery wilderness about 40 miles ahead of me. I didn't know about Danko, but I didn't think Doakes would float very well. Perhaps the GPS could lie after all. Still, I had to do something, so I pulled back onto the road, paid my toll, and continued westward. At a spot parallel to the location on the GPS, a small access road branched off to the right. It was nearly invisible in the dark, especially since I was traveling at 70 miles per hour. But as I saw it whiz past, I braked to a stop on the shoulder of the road and backed up to peer at it. It was a one-lane dirt road that led nowhere, up over a rickety bridge and then straight as an arrow into the darkness of the Everglades. In the headlights of the passing cars, I could only see about 50 yards down the road, and there was nothing to see. A patch of knee-high weeds grew up in the center of the road between the two deeply rutted tire tracks. A clump of short trees hung over the road at the edge of darkness, and that was it. I thought about getting out and looking for some kind of clue until I realized how silly that was. Did I think I was Tonto, faithful Indian guide? I couldn't look at a bent twig and tell how many white men had passed in the last hour. Perhaps Dexter's dutiful but uninspired brain pictured him as Sherlock Holmes, able to examine the wheel ruts and deduce that a left-handed hunchback with red hair and a limp had gone down the road carrying a Cuban cigar and a ukulele. I would find no clues, not that it mattered. The sad truth was, this was either it, or I was all done for the night, and Sergeant Doakes was done for considerably longer. Just to be absolutely sure, or at any rate absolutely free of guilt, I called Doakes's top-secret telephone number again. The voice gave me the same coordinates and hung up. Wherever they were still there, down this dark and dirty little road. I was apparently out of choices. Duty called, and Dexter must answer. I turned the wheel hard and started down the road. According to the GPS, I had about 5.5 miles to travel before I got to whatever was waiting for me. I put my headlights on low and drove slowly, watching the road carefully. This gave me plenty of time to think, which is not always a good thing. I thought about what might be there at the end of the road, and what I would do when I got there. And although it was a rather bad time for this to occur to me, I realized that even if I found Dr. Danko at the end of this road, I had no idea what I was going to do about it. "Come get me," Doakes had said, and it sounded simple enough until you were driving into the Everglades on a dark night with no weapon more threatening than a steno pad.
and Dr. Danko had apparently not had much trouble with any of the others he had taken, in spite of the fact that they were rough, well-armed customers. How could poor, helpless, docile Dexter hope to thwart him when the mighty Dokes had gone down so fast? And what would I do if he got me? I didn't think I would make a very good yodeling potato. I wasn't sure if I could go crazy, since most authorities would most likely say that I already was. Would I snap anyway and go burbling out of my brain to the land of the eternal scream? Or because of what I am, would I remain aware of what was happening to me? Me, precious me, strapped to a table and offering a critique of the dismemberment technique? The answer would certainly tell me a great deal about what I was, but I decided that I didn't really want to know the answer that badly. The very thought was almost enough to make me feel real emotion, and not the kind that one is grateful for. The night had closed in around me, and not in a good way. Dexter is a city boy, used to the bright lights that leave dark shadows. The farther along this road I went, the darker it seemed to get. And the darker it got, the more this whole thing began to seem like a hopeless, suicidal trip. This situation clearly called for a platoon of Marines, not an occasionally homicidal forensic lab geek. Who did I really think I was? Sir Dexter, the Valiant, galloping to the rescue? What could I possibly hope to do? For that matter, what could anyone do except pray? I don't pray, of course. What would something like me pray to, and why should it listen to me? And if I found something, whatever it was, how could it keep from laughing at me, or flinging a lightning bolt down my throat? It would have been very comforting to be able to look to some kind of higher power, but of course, I only knew one higher power. And even though it was strong and swift and clever, and very good at stalking silently through the nightscape, would even the dark passenger be enough? According to the GPS unit, I was within a quarter of a mile of Sergeant Doakes, or at least his cell phone, when I came to a gate. It was one of those wide gates made of aluminum that they use on dairy farms to keep the cows in. But this was no dairy farm. A sign that hung on the gate said, "Blaylock Gator Farm. Trespassers will be eaten." This seemed like a very good place for a gator farm, which didn't necessarily make it the kind of place I wanted to be. I am ashamed to admit that even though I have lived my entire life in Miami, I know very little about gator farms. Did the animals roam freely through watery pastures, or were they pinned in somehow? It seemed like a very important question at the moment. Could alligators see in the dark? And how hungry were they, generally? All good questions, and very relevant. I switched off my headlights, stopped the car, and got out. In the sudden silence, I could hear the engine ticking, the keening of mosquitoes, and, in the distance, music was playing on a tinny speaker. It sounded like Cuban music, possibly Tito Puente. The doctor was in. I approached the gate. The road on the far side still ran straight, up to an old wooden bridge and then into a grove of trees. Through the branches, I could see a light. I didn't see any alligators basking in the moonlight. "Well, Dexter, here we are. And what would you like to do tonight?" At the moment, Rita's couch didn't seem like such a bad place to be, especially compared to standing here in the nighttime wild. On the far side of this gate were a maniacal vivisectionist, hordes of ravenous reptiles, and a man I was supposed to rescue, even though he wanted to kill me. And in this corner, wearing dark trunks, the mighty Dexter. I certainly seem to be asking this an awful lot lately, but why was it always me? I mean, really. Me, braving all this to rescue Sergeant Doakes, of all people. Hello?
Isn't there something wrong with this picture? Like the fact that I'm in it?
Nevertheless, I was here, and might as well go through with it. I climbed over the gate and headed toward the light. The normal night sounds started to return a few at a time. At least I assumed they were normal for out here in the savage primeval forest. There were clicks and hums and buzzes from our insect friends, and a mournful sort of shriek that I very much hoped was only some kind of owl. A small one, please. Something rattled the shrubbery off to my right and then went completely silent. And happily for me, instead of getting nervous or scared like a human being, I found myself slipping into night stalker mode. Sounds shifted down, movement around me slowed, and all my senses seemed to come slightly more alive. The darkness bleached out a little lighter. Details sprang into focus from the night around me. And a slow, cold, careful, silent chuckle began to grow just under the surface of my awareness. Was poor misunderstood Dexter feeling out of his element and over his head? Then let the passenger take the wheel. He would know what to do, and he would do it. And why, after all, not? At the end of this driveway and over the bridge, Dr. Danko was waiting for us. I had been wanting to meet him, and now I would. Harry would approve of anything I did to this one. Even Dokes would have to admit that Danko was fair game. He would probably thank me for it. It was dizzying. This time I had permission. And even better, it had poetry to it. For so very long, Dokes had kept my genie trapped in its bottle. There would be a certain justice if his rescue were to let it out again. And I would rescue him, certainly. Of course I would. Afterward. But first. I crossed the wooden bridge. Halfway over, a board creaked, and I froze for a moment. The night sounds didn't change. And from up ahead, I heard Tito Puente say, "Aya," before returning to his melody. I moved on. On the far side of the bridge, the road widened into a parking area. To the left was a chain-link fence, and straight ahead was a small, one-story building with a light shining in the window. It was old and battered and needed paint, but perhaps Dr. Danko wasn't as thoughtful of appearances as he should have been. Off to the right, a chicky hut moldered quietly beside a canal, chunks of its palm-frond roof dangling like tattered old clothes. An airboat was tied to a dilapidated dock jutting out into the canal. I slid into the shadows cast by a row of trees and felt a predator's cool poise take control of my senses. I circled carefully around the parking area, to the left, along the chain-link fence. Something grunted at me and then splashed into the water, but it was on the other side of the fence, so I ignored it and moved on. The dark passenger was driving and didn't stop for such things. The fence ended in a right-angle turn away from the house. There was one last stretch of emptiness, no more than 50 feet, and one last stand of trees. I moved to the last tree for a good look at the house, but as I paused and placed my hand on the trunk, something crashed and fluttered in the branches above me, and a horribly loud, bugling shriek split the night. I jumped back as whatever it was smashed down through the leaves of the tree and onto the ground. Still making a sound like an insane, over-amplified trumpet, the thing faced me. It was a large bird, bigger than a turkey, and it was apparent from the way he hissed and hooted that he was angry at me. It strutted a step forward, whisking a massive tail across the ground, and I realized that it was a peacock. Animals don't like me, but this one seemed to have formed an extreme and violent hatred. I suppose it didn't understand that I was much bigger and more dangerous.
It seemed intent on either eating me or driving me away. And since I needed the hideous caterwauling din to stop as quickly as possible, I obliged him with a dignified retreat and hurried back along the fence to the shadows by the bridge. Once I was safely tucked into a quiet pool of darkness, I turned to look at the house. The music had stopped, and the light was out. I stood frozen in my shadow for several minutes. Nothing happened, except that the peacock quit its bugling and, with a final mean-spirited mutter in my direction, fluttered back up into his tree. And then the night sounds came back again. The clicks and whines of the insects and another snort and splash from the alligators. But no more Tito Puente. I knew that Dr. Danko was watching and listening just as I was, that each of us was waiting for the other to make some move. But I could wait longer. He had no idea what might be out there in the dark. For all he could tell, it might be either a SWAT team or the Delta Rho Glee Club. And I knew that there was only him. I knew where he was, and he couldn't know if there was someone on the roof or even if he was surrounded. And so he would have to do something first. And there were just two choices. Either he had to attack or... At the far end of the house, there came the sudden roar of an engine, and as I tensed involuntarily, the airboat leaped away from the dock. The engine revved higher, and the boat raced off down the canal. In less than a minute, it was gone, around a bend and away into the night. And with it went Dr. Danko.